Maryland's 5/8 Mile Training Track completes the full-service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to get your career in horse racing off to a fast start? Well, the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standard bred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Leader Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Sirius XM Sports presents
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Enough! Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We are back in the main hall. And it's kind of funny this morning because things are getting started in the next in the next really 10 minutes, and there is not that same pre-show, the pre-presentation throng.
Well, I'll tell you why, because the bar was rolling last night, people are rolling in just a little bit slower this morning, and that I can tell you for sure. So, I'm a witness to that. So
you were a participant.
I was a participant and a witness. So I can
don't limit it to witness. I would have been a witness because I don't drink.
Yes, I was. I was embedded, and I tried to get out. I couldn't get out. So. Anyway, one of the early ones was Dora here, Dora Delgado. We saw her walking by with Frank, and who's, I don't know, I say that she runs the Breeders' Cup, so that's good enough for me, because I've been fortunate enough to work with Dora and the Breeders' Cup, her people, for 7 times, been around, longer than that, but she is the greatest. And I mean that. And when I say that, we have to work with different people in different committees, all over the place in what we do. But when she and her, and I mentioned your crew, all of them, they've got a great crew, come to town and virtually take over. You kind of have to work together, and it's been such a fun time, which right. It's supposed to be. Doesn't look like fun out there, but we have our moments. But the exchange of information, I think, is the main thing. We talk to each other. Mm-hmm. Hey, can we do this? How do we get this done? And couldn't have you walk by without talking to you and also commending you on a home run at Keeneland, not that long ago, a month ago. Was there for that one, and it went smooth.
It feels like it was so, 6 months ago already. Yeah, it's amazing.
But thanks, Rick. I really appreciate that.
Well, Dora, one thing about conversations with you that we rarely have time for is the backstory and your, because it, as far as I recall, you've been running the Breeders' Cup racing office officially from a title standpoint, EVP and chief racing officer of Breeders' Cup. But I mean, for as long as I've been doing this.
Yeah.
Dora Delgado. You got to see Dora Delgado. Go see Dora.
I'm kind of synonymous with Breeders' Cup at this point.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Well, I'm glad I got the purple microphone
Thank you.
Top.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, the funny thing is Breeders' Cup and I have literally grown up together. You know, I have been with the Breeders' Cup since day one, practically. And so, you know, everything, every step of the way, every decision, wrong or right, you know, I've been there for. So I think, you know, when you have that kind of longevity at one company, you do make an impression on people eventually. They're like, I know one person there.
How did you give, and in fact, today it even fits in to your presentation involvement today. Mm-hmm. Amy Zimmerman, I think, is moderating the Expanding Racing's Reach, Strategies for Diversity and Inclusion. Yeah. I mean, when you talk about the 3+ decades of the Breeders' Cup, that is a horizon, in fact. And how did you get to the racing game to begin with, and then, you know, basically get in on the escalator at the ground floor?
Yeah, it's kind of a funny story. My grandfather was a trainer. Tony Basil was leading trainer at Keeneland for many years for the great Wamazon Farm, right? So I grew up around the racetracks. We'd spend summers at Arlington and Monmouth and travel, you know, whenever we had breaks in school. So it was a great education, not only, you know, learning how to behave at the racetrack, but also, you know, meeting my grandfather's clients and going out to dinner. And so, you know, that kind of just set the foundation. I didn't think I was going to have a career in racing. Honestly, it never occurred to me when I was going to school. But the Breeders' Cup had just gotten started. They were in the basement of the Blood Horse. There was like four people, and they needed an administrative assistant. And
wow.
I needed a job over the summer, you know, and the rest is just history. I have literally worked my way up from ground floor. So
and have not really had any other
no,
job.
That's right there, yeah.
The only paycheck you've received is Breeders' Cup
yes,
Limited.
Yes.
Was Pat there?
Pat Cobb?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
She actually came after me. She was hired. There was, I think it was, we had DG, Fergie, Claudia Starr. I don't know if you remember Claudia. She did marketing. And
DG
one
Van
other.
Cleef, and it all starts
Ferguson
with.
Ferguson Taylor, yeah. That was it. I mean, that was,
wow.
You know. They needed somebody to do the data entry and put all the fulls in and balance the deposits. And I was like, I'm your man. So, you know, and I just literally, I think that's my whole career path. And one of the things I'll talk about today is that, you know, the ability to say, yes, I'll do that job, or I'll take that on, or, you know, I'll learn how to do it if I don't know how to do it. That feeling of just making sure that, you know, whatever needed to be done, I was there to volunteer to do it. It gives you such an immense diversity of skill sets when you're like, I'll do that, you know. And, you know, instead of pigeonholing, and that's really kind of one of the things I always tell, you know, mentees is, you know, don't pigeonhole yourself into one slot. You just never know where your paths are going to take you, and that skill set that you learned may come in useful, you know, down the road.
I think one of the reasons when you say, go see Dora, is because of that attitude. And in any office or in any environment, there's people that step up and there's people that step back and hope they don't get asked anything.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, you see that. And Dora's always been the one that, you know, you could go to Dora to get the question answered.
I'll find the solution. If I don't know it, I'm going to find it.
And in this game, it's if you don't know the answer, you can't fake it because they know you're getting a bad answer.
Yeah.
So the idea is you call someone that if they don't know the answer, they're going to tell you who to call to
right.
get the answer.
Right.
And so that's
100%.
Right. I mean, 100%. More so than anything, you get the, hey, you get calls for phone numbers. Well, I don't have the number, but you know what? I'll get you the
yeah.
number type of thing.
It was so funny. There was a, you know, one of these guys that I worked with over the years at one of the events goes, you know, well, what do you know about turf courses? You know what I mean? Like, you don't know if they're, you know, if they're good or bad. I'm like, I may not know, but I know who to call to know that's going to know
good.
That, you know? I mean, I could take a look and see, but more importantly, I have so many, you know, track superintendents that I'm, you know, besties with at this point
sure.
that, you know, I'll find out the answer.
You know, one of the things that Rick, for me anyway, was kind of the conduit to this. There had been a period, and I'm sure you'll acknowledge this, there had been a period going back where the reputation or the you know, the suggestion was made, well, Breeders' Cup comes in and they run things, they take over, mm-hmm. and you know, the local racetrack doesn't have any say about anything. And so that was, you know, that was sort of this,
yeah,
this murmur. And then I remember bringing, I remember asking you about it, and you said, when they come here, and I've got my conduit is the best there is, and that, you know, that was sort of a neutering, mm-hmm. and you know, at least from my awareness, you know, portion of it, right. that meme was not fair, and it was
right.
It was really not true.
It was a general impression that we just come in, you know, we just take over, and it's like no, it's more like a little purple layer we umbrella we put over
it's a purple
everybody.
Haze.
It's
purple
a purple haze. Haze. Everybody still has to do their jobs at the racetrack. You know, we're not supplanting any of that. We want everything to go as smoothly as possible, and that means letting people still do the jobs that they know how to do. We just add a little purple color to it.
a tinting. There you go.
Yes, and we, you know, we've grown. I mean, both I think racetracks and you have grown, and there was a little, you know, small wall there that years and years and years ago where it was kind of us and them type of thing, mm-hmm. and you know, it's like, well, mm-hmm. why? But through discussion and through you know, talking it out, we'd have those meetings sitting around the big table and go over, and it all comes down to communication.
That's right.
We, as long as we know what each other's doing and what we want, we have it. And that the relationship has just grown. I mean,
That's true.
All racetracks, just with
and
here.
The issue is, too, is that Breeders' Cup itself is a small company. We're 28 people. So we rely entirely on people that give up their vacations to come and work at Breeders' Cup for us. You know, it's just part of this huge team we build, but they're not, you know, they're contract labor, they're consultants, and my equine security team is, you know, upwards of 30 people. They take their vacations away from, you know, their families and their normal jobs to come and, you know, do this work for a week. We pull in all their, you know, our great regulatory vets to be on the Breeders' Cup vet team. I say, you know, honestly, at Breeders' Cup, there can't be anybody running anything at any racetrack because they're all with us
exactly.
that week.
That's a good point. You look around and you see, that's true. I mean, because it's also, it's like an industry conclave.
Yeah.
We
literally
in a lot
couldn't
of ways.
Do it with all that industry knowledge and skills that they bring to us. I mean, like we're so dependent on them, and we're so thankful that there's such a great integration with the host track. You know, that all these people that we bring in could be so disruptive, but everybody's on message, everybody's collaborating, everybody's working together.
Talk about the growth of the European and how the relationship has grown mm-hmm. there, where, you know, we used to Please. We almost hope, and now it's more of an organization coming here and getting things done, and that's not an easy
it
deal
isn't.
Either.
It isn't, and you know, international competition has been so critical to Breeders' Cup since day one. We knew if we wanted to be a world championship, we had to have those internationals target us at the end of the year. It varies greatly based on where we're running, right? So when we're in California, we're going to have a huge number of internationals who like hard ground. You know, when we are in Keeneland, we're at Churchill, we're going to get those horses that are, you know, want a little softer. And the issue is that they have soft ground at home. So, you know, unless our purses are huge, unless we're offering that entertainment value and that event experience, it's a hard sell to say, leave your home where you know you've got an easy win against competition and come and take on the best in the world at the Breeders' Cup. So, you know, that's part of our whole recruitment package is, you know, don't stay home. Come here. This is going to be, you know, as Mulvihill said yesterday, you know, it's the party, right? It's the poem, the puzzle, and the party. We're the party at the end of the rainbow. You want to be there because that's where everybody in racing is. That's where the best horses are, the best trainers, the best jockeys.
And the Breeders' Cup experience has turned into more than just a day at the races for the people that come. I mean, right. You provide, right. You know, from the top of the top, mm-hmm. to, you know, the average fan coming in and, you know, standing as they always do. And it wasn't always that way. And I think you've turned it into that, quote, party atmosphere for the people that come.
Yeah, we definitely had to make sure the experience that they had was rivaled anywhere in the world. You know, we're a non-invitational event, so we have to make sure that people are going to pay a great deal of money to come to us. They are going to pay entry fees. They're going to pay their own airline, their own hotels. We have added more along the way in the fact that we offer equine travel support. There's a stipend for internationals. There's a stipend for domestics. We now pay owners hotel bills three nights. We do complimentary airport transfers for executive car service. I mean, there's more that goes into it since we're not an invitational. You know, everybody's trying to hit one of those challenge races because that's going to cover your entry fees. You know, so that's a big plus. It's been a game changer.
Well, and expand on that for a minute. Dora Delgado is with us. Jessica Paquette is going to join us in a moment, and they're on a panel together, which we're going to talk about. But it almost feels, looking back, Dora, that the win and you're in concept felt like a bit of a novelty, mm-hmm. and it turned into a central tenet of the entire calendar and the schedule of Breeders' Cup. And when you hear big owners that you wouldn't think the 10,000 would mean all that much to, when you hear them say, "Well, we're trying to get a win, and you're in," and it obviously resonates.
Remember. The early win and you're in, it just got you a spot.
In the starting gate.
You didn't get any money. And now remember, going.
Okay, then that's not a win
and
you're in.
That's not worse though. I won. I just won $1 million. Of course I'm in.
And, clearly.
But that's a small, but the evolution of that has turned into, hey, if I'm going to run in race A or B, and if I win here, I'm going to not have to pay the entry fees. So of course I'm going to go over there.
It's massive. You know what we figured out along the way is that rich people like free stuff. You know, they really do. They, you know, if you say, you know, we're going to add $10,000 to the purse, they're like, yawn. But if you say we're going to give you $10,000 in your owner's account to pay for your shipping, they love it.
It's
funny.
It's
so true. You have these people that are, you know, well off people that come into the racetrack, come into the office. Hey, you got a program? Ah, oh, we're out. I need a program. I mean, they don't want to, you know, they want that program, you know, just to walk through the door. And but you want to take care of them.
Well, there's certain perks that are supposed to come with ownership and with involvement in the game. And we should, you know, we should celebrate it and absolutely try to maximize it. One of the incredibly annoying frustrations in New York was having that racing and wagering board come in and start to penny earnily take away spouse passes. Are you kidding me?
I know.
You got people, they're paying $3,000 a month to maintain a horse, mm-hmm. and you're going to take away a $6 admission from the owner's spouse? Are you stupid?
It is crazy. But you know, that's why we've really built up that owner package. You know, it's like, we want you to come because, you know, we do have a little, you know, internal, you know, mantra here is we're going to have 14 winners and we're going to have a whole lot of other people that are
losers.
Not winners. We don't use the L word.
They do. We lost.
But, you know, we want to make sure that they've had a great time. It's like, we came, we went, we took on the best. We didn't win, but my God, we had we went to great parties. We had breakfast every day at the track. We got treated by the Breeders' Cup racing and ticketing teams as, you know, VIPs, and that's, you know, that's why we do it for. We are honestly, we pride ourselves so much on our concierge service and our willingness to just go the extra mile because it's important. We're trying to get 165 horses to come there and race, you know, and sometimes they're going to take on a horse like Flightline, you know. Like, so you know that you're probably running for second or third, you know. So we got to convince you to come, and it's all part of the package that we can offer them.
You know, one of the more recent innovations, I would call innovation, or what you've done is make the mornings much more attractive.
Yeah.
We used to, you know, you go to the morning workouts and, you know, watch the horses, maybe pick up a donut or two along the way.
Yeah.
Now they have the breakfast marquee, where you can go there in the morning and have a nice breakfast, overlooks the track, you know.
One of our greatest success stories is our breakfast marquee, because it's like almost like you're breaking bread before you go to war, right? You're coming in, you have that camaraderie and the energy of all the owners and trainers and jockeys and internationals are all in one spot, and it's before the game, right? So you're, you know, the energy is just so great. I think every morning out there, it's really fun.
Got to ask one question, then I want to bring Jess in and turn to your conversation today. Dora, in terms of, I would guess, the most pointed conversation leading, and it's not just this year, it's on a regular basis, as people were watching the decision-making process of Life is Good, of Cyberknife, particularly, and others, classic division horses, moving instead, particularly younger horse, three-year-olds that are, you know, going to stay on and look to the future. Nick's Go, a good example. Dirt Mile to the classic. Life is Good, Dirt Mile to the classic. The juvenile card, and then the Saturday card. How much post event discussion is there, has there been, in terms of adjusting, you know, some of that? Is 14 just right? Is 14 too many? Is a race like the juvenile turf sprint kind of a silly race?
There's a huge amount of discussion. We have a racing and nominations committee as well that meets annually, sometimes semi-annually, depending on what we've got to discuss, but that's always a conversation. Like, we moved all the juveniles to Future Stars Friday, and it's really worked well. The wagering's up. The trainers really like getting the two-year-olds kind of out of the way on Friday so they can concentrate Saturday on the bigger races. I swear we could add, you know, a juvenile Phillies turf sprint, and it would also get 24 horses. I mean, the baby turf races are immensely popular. They always overfill. When we originally added the juvenile turf sprint, it was really to solve a need for our European stallions that were coming into our international stallion program. Because in 2010, we disbanded our partnership with the EBF and just created our own international stallion program. So those Northern Hemisphere stallions standing in England could nominate for 50% of their stud fee, but then all their foals would be free. They didn't have to pay the individual foal fee. But there was a lot of turf sprinter sires that we wanted to get in the program, and that kind of fulfilled the need. We were also trying to see if, you know, maybe we could, you know, encourage the racing secretaries here in the States to start writing a few more of those, and they did. I mean, they supported it with a couple of races for our division.
Well, remember that kind of evolved at Santa Anita when the Juvenile Mile got so many horses we rode a down the hill race just to kind of give them a place to run, and then all of a sudden, for the 3 years that we were in a row there, We put that race on the calendar, and boy, that worked too. And then it's kind of evolved into, you know, the 5/8 race, and that's actually the reason that we put this quietly put the 5/8 turf course in at Santa Anita, just strictly for that one Breeders' Cup to see how it worked. And now they've made that into a bigger course. But that's where that thing evolved from. And now, like Doris says, I think it was overfilled. And let's not forget, the Breeders' Cup is a fun and a party, but it's a business.
Yeah.
So, you know, 14 or 12 horse fields are what
those
they're
are
looking for.
Yeah.
I mean, the handle's what makes the thing work. So,
I mean, there's also been a lot of conversation. I think it comes up every year. Is the Dirt Mile cannibalizing the Classic and the Sprint too much? You know, it's always a conversation. We tackle it at the committee level. We tackle it at the board level. You can't deny how popular it is and that it's a stallion maker in certain, you know, aspects. One of the reasons we keep the purse at $1 million is to create that separation between the $6 million Classic and the $1 million Dirt Mile. Like, you can run shorter and you can run cheaper, but if you're going to go for the big prize, we wanted to make sure we had some separation in there.
Well, take this year, because I, you know, I go both sides of that argument, and for Steve's
betting companion,
I 2 years in a row I've been assigned the Mile, so I kind of, you know, go with up and back and look at them a little deeper. I don't think there was a horse in the Mile this year that really belonged in the Classic.
Cyberknife, you could make the argument.
Going a mile and a quarter, maybe, you know, but maybe you could have, but or that belonged in the Sprint, so to speak. I think this was the model year. Like, you know what? These are where
those
these
were
horses
dirt
belong.
Milers,
those
yeah.
were dirt
You're
milers.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
And so what do? You make a guy run that's going to be, I'll have to go over here and pay a lot of money to run sixth or seventh. Now you're like, he's got a comfortable home where he can run
and
compete.
And to go back to the previous point, that's 12 horses, that's 12 owners that get to come and experience the event, right? That's what we're trying to do, is get more people involved in racing. So if you give you have another race on that brings another 12 owners in or another opportunity for the owners you have, it's all good. You know, it's what we're here for, really.
Quick question then about the sprints. The filly and mare 7/8. We'd had several lean years of the 3/4, you know, which, by all rights in American racing, should be an absolute cornerstone bastion event. And for whatever reason, there was a strange, bereft period. It seemed to gird up a little bit this year.
Yeah.
And one of the great, some of the great historic sprints. In Breeders' Cup history involved fillies facing males. And, you know, we still have some that are doing it because of distance preference.
Right.
And I happen to love the 7/8 filly and mare sprint, but, you know, there's another discussion point that, you know, that some people saying, you know, we could have 14 every year in the 3/4 sprint. Why are we siphoning off?
That's true. That's true. I mean, you know, in that it just comes back to, again, you know, are we trying to, you know, are we trying to get back to our seven or eight races? Are we trying to expand more opportunities? The filly and mare sprint, you know, at seven versus the boys at six does give a little bit of separation. All of our races that are not exclusive to filly and mares are open, you know, other than the juvenile colts. But so, you know, you've got opportunities. There's you know, Linda Rice had that great mare, you know, that she was debating, you know, go against the girls or go against the boys because her preference was six furlongs.
Laverdad,
yeah. So they've got the option.
Dora Delgado is with us. Jessica Paquette just climbed down the mountain. I hope were you chased by a what are they called? The javelino?
Javelina.
The wild boar. You didn't see a javelina?
There was no wildlife, but I don't eat pork, so I feel like the pigs and I would get along. I felt I was very safe out there.
I love it. Jess joining us, and of course, taking a couple of days away from the race announcement responsibilities at Parks, which we will talk about. But given, Dora, your presence on the Expanding Racing's Reach Strategies for Diversion Inclusion panel comes up at 10 o'clock, I think it's a unique opportunity to, you know, talk about a topic that is just nonstop thorny and difficult. Mm. It's an industry, certainly on the backstretch, that you could say is ripe with sexism and even dangerous scenarios for women. And I mean, in the boardroom, it's a much different story. Although glass ceiling issues, I mean, you've had this horizon view and have had this unique career arc with Breeders' Cup. You brought in an assistant in Courtney Reed, who herself was having a ascendant career, leaving the NSA, the steeplechase community. Talk about your view of this topic and maybe hit on some of the themes you expect to voice today.
Sure. You know, the opportunities for women in the business are always there, but, you know, there's a certain hesitancy that I think people coming into the industry don't see those open doors, you know. And it's one thing that we've really tried to make sure that, you know, at Breeders' Cup, we're like 18 to 10, you know, 18 women versus 10 men. Like, so we've always been very...
Of the 28 full-time employees.
We've always been very women-centric, you know. And we're, you know, we're led by Barbara Banky as our chairman, you know, and I am one of five executives at VP or above. There are seven males. So, I mean, it's fairly even. We've been very open about that. There's opportunities, I think, right now into really making sure that youth that we're trying to attract in the business doesn't see it as an old white man sport, right? I mean, that's what we're all trying to...
Even though it is.
It is. But it's there's opportunities there to mold it and to move it in new directions. And I say this all the time. It's like it needs somebody to own it. And I don't think we in American racing have that person, have that organization yet. And it could be something like we have to come together like we did for the Safety Coalition. Naomi Howgate is going to talk on our panel about the BHA's initiatives. And, you know, they made a commitment. They got organizations to sign the commitment to say, we're going to do this. We're going to self-check ourselves. You know, we're not just going to say we put it in place and good luck, you know, that they're going to go back and say, is it working? Do we need to fix something else? And I honestly think that's what we need here in America.
Well, and Jess, you know, your experience even before, I want you to weigh in, you know, your experience on this front, even before getting the race call job at Parks, which has, I've never seen one individual hire create such an insane and unwarranted reaction. But we'll, that's a separate topic. Your experience, because you've had a fascinating set of responsibilities that you have found yourself in, including communications professional services, PR, and you know, the turf publicity work, on-air talent, myriad racetracks. So you've dealt with a big variety of potential employers. What's your experience to date before 3 weeks ago?
But definitely before 3 weeks ago. It's been an interesting 3 weeks. No one gets where they get on their own. And, you know, I got many of my opportunities in racing because women came before me and paved the way, kicked down some doors, and made the path a little bit easier. That does not mean that it was super easy, even still. I remember early on in my career at Suffolk Downs as the on-air analyst. I remember walking down to the paddock one day and a gentleman stopped me and he said, "Who writes your notes for you?" As in, wasn't making my selections on my own. That some, I assume, a white man in the publicity office was making my notes for me. And this was 15, almost 20 years ago. But that mentality does still persist to an extent. Mm-hmm. And my approach has always been
pervade.
Yeah, you know, I've tried to always just take it with a sense of humor and a grain of salt and understand, you know, just keep your head down, do the job, and let your work speak for itself. But I think, as a woman in any prominent position in the industry, our job at this point is to show that we can do anything, obviously, but also to pave the way and make the way easier for the generation behind us.
I'll ask you both as an umbrella question or statement that you can react to, which is the industry, I think of it as more inclusive than I think, you know, certainly outsiders would think. Right. For starters, we're the only sport of any real renown where men and women compete equally on the field of play.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's number one. That also includes the equine athlete. We should note, but female riders are they've been for 50 years essentially, and they faced real issues. Any morning you are at a racetrack watching horses work, what do you, 40% of the exercise riders are female?
At least, yeah,
right?
I would say.
For sure.
But somewhere, I'd say between 40 and 50%. Then you look around the racetrack, and there's women in executive positions, you know, widely. And in fact, all you got to do is look at who's on these panels. You know, obviously aftercare is dominated by female management. It may be a delicate balance, but I mean, I'm an observer, obviously. I can only see and then get a read on what, you know, the actual frontline, you know, female participants say when these topics come up, and just respect their, you know, their travail. But it does feel like the opportunities are there, and that we're a little bit better than probably a lot of other industries. And that's just a casual observation.
And we shouldn't confuse progress with perfection, or lose sight of the progress we've made in search of perfection.
You know, kind of like Steve, I'm an observer. I've worked and hired many people, and, you know, and all kinds of, from outriders to, you know, test barn workers to office personnel. And, you know, personally myself, you know, I could care less if it's who it is. You know, it's basically, if you fit the job, you're in. And so I naively just figure, hey, it was no big deal. But, you know, more recently, in not just in racing, but in the general public, you know, the stories are coming out, you know, and I'm glad to hear that, you know, that really what's been going on, some in the background here, that, you know, some of the trials and tribulations that you've had, you know, to get to those spots. It's kind of eye-opening to me, because I've just had a blind eye, because it's just not the way I think, and I've never really, you know, noticed. I've never been told, hey, you don't hire a girl, or don't hire this guy. I, you know,
most people aren't going to say that part out loud. That's the thing. It's, they will, the people that don't want women in these prominent positions, or are uncomfortable by it, or triggered by it, they're never going to come out and say, we don't like women. They know they can't. So they will,
I think 20 years ago, You could have said that, and I maybe I've been fortunate enough to work for people that are, they never even inferred it to me, because I wouldn't have put up with it anyway. But, you know, so I'm kind of glad to hear the stories, and you know, appreciate what you know you've gone to, and also to have someone like Dora here to be almost like a Statue of Liberty there, like, you know, we can do it, and.
I think that's exactly right. You know, the nobody's ever going to stand up in front of you and go, you know, yeah, I don't want to hire a person of color, or I'm uncomfortable around an LGBTQ. Nobody's ever going to say that. It's that subtle, you know, just, I'm not going to call them back for a second interview. I'm not, you know, I'm going to look elsewhere.
Or they hire them and don't invite them golfing or to lunches, and you get iced out of some of these opportunities where, you know, a bunch of men will go golfing, and that's where decisions are made, or that's where relationships are made, and you just don't get the invitation, regardless of whether you golf or whether
that's
you
right.
are, you know, up at that same executive level. You miss out on some of those opportunities.
And part of the issue, and we talked about this at the Women's Summit we had out at Santa Anita, is that when you do a really good job as a woman, there's a, you know, they don't want to promote you, because then who's going to do that really good job you've been doing, right? They don't believe that there's another one coming up behind, you know? So if they do give you the promotion, then you just do that job on top of your other job.
Yes.
You know, it's just an additional, you know.
If you want something done, ask a busy woman.
Right, exactly. You know, so I think there's, you know, there's subtle layers of, you know, benign neglect, you know.
Yes.
They might park you in a situation and go, she's a superstar. She's doing everything right. We can give her anything. But are you including her in the thought processes, in the collaboration? Are you looking for opportunities for that person to advance? Or are you just looking for opportunities to add more responsibilities? Those are way two separate things.
And I think many of us coming up, we have felt that we had to work twice as hard and be twice as dedicated to get the same opportunities.
You mentioned Barbara Banky. I'll bring up Charlotte Weber, who has got, you know, 40 years of involvement at the highest level on boards, and you know, as a breeder owner. Jamie Roth and Ellen Jay, fairly new, but have very quickly become prominent. How much influence, and more than influence, how much demand can, you know, the elite ownership type of woman impact on this? And is there either behind the scenes or active suggestion going on that the industry be a leader in this area? Because considering all the things where we're maligned and attacked, this feels like a pretty easy win to get out in front and to wave a banner on that topic, because the contributions and the abilities of the women that are so well established is clear. Not to mention that probably would be better off in a lot of cases. Yeah. with a true balance.
Right. And I think the women that are on our board, that serve as members, that are some of the backbone of our Breeders' Cup nominator base and our owner base, are at the point in their careers and their lives where they have made it, right? They're at the top of their profession. They are comfortable in their dealings with men. It's almost, like when you get there, do you pull everybody up behind you, or do you say, I made it on my own, good luck, here, get the tools you need along the way, talk to network the people that you need to. But, the fact that women in this business trying to band together to lift more women up is got its grassroots right now. I think it's starting to happen. We realize we have to open those doors, to make sure that we attract people to this business that have other skills other than being born into the right family. And, it's a necessity. I mean, you can't have a business based on pedigrees and not have pedigrees in people's lineage, It's part and parcel. But if we need to make sure that we also are extending opportunities for people outside the industry to bring their skill sets in. Because, if you're just in an echo chamber all the time, you're just going to wither and die. We've got to have outside thought processes, diversity, inclusion, diversity of thought, inclusivity of different personalities, different people are brought up in different manners, right? They're not all brought up on a horse farm. They're not all brought up in Detroit. Everybody brings experience to the table. And when you limit that and when you don't have diversity and inclusivity in your business plan, you're just in an echo chamber, and it's not healthy.
And it's interesting because the backside of the racetrack is one of the most diverse and interesting groups of people. Yeah. And it's such a beautiful environment where you can learn. I mean, I was a pretty sheltered kid. When I got to Suffolk Downs, I got to meet a bunch of people who were not like me, who did not grow up like I did, and it opened my worldview in a way that I don't know if I ever would have had that opportunity otherwise. Yeah. And it's interesting that there are just two sides of the industry where we have this, big melting pot, and then it can be a little harder.
Yeah, it's a dichotomy. It's just, like every breeder, every owner that you talk to, nobody would say, no, I don't want to hire a person of color. No, I don't want to have an LGBTQ on my staff. They would never say that. But do they have that? No, because it might just be that they've not had the opportunity to have somebody come and apply for that job, because are we looking like an industry that has open doors? Are we to the outside world, do we look like we want diversity? I don't think so.
Mm-mm.
We have to look like that. We have to present ourselves to a global sports audience and a fan base that says everybody's welcome.
There's a seat for everyone here.
Absolutely.
Dora Delgado with us from Breeders' Cup, Jessica Paquette with us from Parks, and Jess. certainly, in terms of fresh bruises on this topic, you've had a trial by fire over the last 2 weeks.
First one through the wall gets all the arrows.
Your thoughts? What should we know about this experience thus far?
That I do read the Twitter comments, and that there's a human being behind the internet, people. That I shouldn't read the Twitter comments, but I do.
In fact, Jess was the first person that I saw when I walked through the doors of the hotel. She was standing there, and we went up and talked for a while, and that's what we talked about. Is you got to turn that off.
You do, but I think that anyone that says they are not reading those things and not bothered by them is not human, first off. And I, you know, I'm trying to block out the noise and just do the best job I can. I understand there's a huge learning curve with this adventure, and you know, this is a major signal. I am very green. I understand all that. But that actually speaks to a broader kind of issue we're facing in racing, right, where with the reduction of racing dates and the reduction of small tracks and small circuits, there becomes less and less of an opportunity for someone new to something like this to ply the trade and learn the skills. And for me, growing up, many of my announcer peers, they saw representation of themselves when they were little kids and decided, I wanted to be an announcer because I wanted to be like Tom Durkin, or I wanted to be like Dave Johnson, or any of these people. There was no woman doing this that I, as a little kid, I didn't see myself in this role. And I think that really matters. For me as a kid growing up as a racing fan, I didn't think women could be announcers. There was no one.
There were commentators. There was Charles, sure. There was Charles C. And
they broke down that wall for me to go be a broadcaster.
Which is helpful. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because that's interesting that
representation really matters.
Yeah, it makes sense. And it basically fits this whole dialogue, which is if there's people that look like you and have your background and are role model potential, something to aspire to, it's a lot easier than sort of manifesting, you know, conjuring it up out of nowhere.
Right. 100%. You know, when Ray Daniels is going to talk on our panel as well about the Ed Brown Society and how they've been introducing people of color back into racing, you know, through syndications, through partnerships, because, like, where would they look to see who would look like them at the races? You know, it's not even part of this really the backstretch community any longer, because that's mostly Latinos these days, you know. So there was a real, you know, gap where you know, people of color were in the menial positions at a racetrack, right? You'd have the African American lady in the restrooms, you know, handing out towels. You have the grooms on the backstretch. So I think the stigma of that lasted so long that they really needed to come at it from a different perspective as owners. You're a part of this game, you know, at this level. You're equal. There is no difference between you owning a horse and going to the track to watch it run and, you know, the Queen of England. You're the same. You know, you can be here. And I think that it's really opened a lot of eyes. It's opened it's opened the eyes of some of the students that were going through the UK Equine Project. I mean, I'm assuming, you know, that those things are really going to have a lasting impact, because just what we've seen initially this year from the scholarships that they provided and the support that the Ed Brown Society is getting from, you know, major organizations, Churchill, the first group, Keeneland, you know, to help fund those scholarships and help bring those people. But what we really need to fight against, honestly, is that they're not unicorns, you know, right? Everybody doesn't need to fight over the one LGBTQ person that says, I want to go in the horse business, you know, because we want to pat ourselves on the back and say, you know, see, we had an open door. We got him, you know. Like, it's got to be normal. We got to strive for normalcy and not the unicorn that everybody's trying to grab and say, oh, you know, look at us. We're not, you know, we're open to anything. Yeah, well, there's one. Where's the rest of them, you know? And that funnel, that pathway from like, as we were talking, from outside the industry in is just vital. We have got to open those doors.
I don't want to be a novelty as the only female announcer.
Exactly.
I want women to come behind me and be better than me. And I want it to be as normal as, you know, every male announcer.
Yeah. A couple of thoughts. I mean, one of the things, particularly when it comes to the African-American quotient, part of what, and really the some of the challenges that the game faces from a societal shift, is really the narrowing of opportunity for proximity to agrarian life. There's just not. I mean, I grew up in Connecticut, fairly rural Connecticut. In fact, this came. We talked about this on Monday, and so, you know, we saw farms and you know, as a student, in elementary school, they would take us, you know, to a lot of, you know, the back of a grocery stores, even, I mean, to that level, and to Yukon to, mm-hmm. you know, to see the chicken hatcheries and so forth. There aren't as many people that are growing up and they in the course of a week see a horse. I mean, Kentucky's unique. Northern Central Florida with Ocala is unique. Upstate New York, has a degree. You know, certain breeding regional breeding grounds have it, but not. And there's a culture of horse racing in Hot Springs and obviously again Kentucky, but it that part of the landscape has really changed. And so, I mean, in terms of, you talk about the Latin community, I mean, they're coming from Latin America off of farms and off of where they've been caring for animals, and we just have less and less of that. So the demographic has changed, and I've said this forever, there's very few racing organizations that are even trying to take advantage of marketing to that culture. I'll be at Los Al Saturday for the Starlet, and they'll wrap up the afternoon card, and then I'll come back, I'll have dinner, we'll come back 2 hours later, and there's this entire Latin community there for the quarters. That's like a complete, it's a completely different set of patrons.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And where are we? Why are those guys with the hats and the belt buckles and the boots, why are they not coming? I mean, you see a few at mm-hmm. Santa Anita and mm-hmm. so forth, but, you know, Naira has been very active in trying to market and develop an audience. Give DRF tremendous credit with what they're doing with the broadcasting the race. Excuse me, in Spanish. We've got all these Latin riders and all these Latin trainers that we could be marketing, and we don't do a thing. It's an embarrassment. We're embarrassed that we've got such a high percentage of Latins that are involved in the game? It doesn't occur that... Why are we not on Telemundo on Saturdays?
Exactly.
I don't get it.
I don't either. You know, and I think part of our issue is that we have been positioning racing as such a glamorous and exclusive event, you know, because we want that cachet, those influencers to think, you know, let's go there and see, you know, racing and put it out on social media. But it doesn't connect. It doesn't connect with the people that are really passionate about racing that just want to go see my horse. I groom this horse. My uncle is assistant trainer for this guy. You know, like, we're not, there are definitely two audiences, and how we market and how we play to them is you know, not the same. Not the same at
I
all.
Completely agree.
It's again myopic. It's self-defeating.
We almost seem embarrassed by our core customer.
That's been the case forever. The gambling side of it, the core customer is the gambler, and the elite have been embarrassed by the horse player from day one. I mean, that's at the centerpiece of our issues.
And
as
I think
an
there's
industry.
Room for all of it. There's room for the hats and the parties and the cocktails, and there's also room for the. I'm a Grinch like you. That's none of that is for me either. But I'm trying to be inclusive here. We're going to include everybody.
Everybody's got a seat at the table.
You know, if you want to wear your, that's fine. But there's also room for the person in gray sweatpants at Suffolk Downs on a Tuesday afternoon too. Mm-hmm. There's room for everybody.
Well, one question too, and this is fabulous, and actually it's been overdue. I'm going to have Michelle Fisher join us momentarily, and Matt Cosgrove from MGM, BetMGM. Pat Cummings is going to stop by. Lisa Lazarus will join us at the bottom of the next hour. Yeah, I got a question online, which is interesting and part of the difficulty, I suppose, in this, which is the merit aspect. And you know, I suppose, Jess, you know, part of the backlash or the, you know, the hubbub is, you know, what, how does she leapfrog, you know, XYZ, etc. And if merit is being determined by a male, you know, a set of male board members, how does actually, you know, how do you actually move up if there's a blockade on that topic?
You know, you have to have a male mentor that's willing to say, I'm going to give her the credit. I'm going to bring her to the table. She's going to have an equal voice, because it's not just a seat at the table. you can be in the audience, you know, you can be around the table, but if you don't have the voice to say, I'm part of this conversation, I've got something to add. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I was in a board meeting or a committee meeting and I voiced something, got no response, and then, you know, 15 minutes later, a male voiced the same thing I did, and it was like, that's a brilliant idea. And I'm like,
that's,
ah!
That's the classic.
And we've all, and we have all had, you know, these male allies who really did gave us a seat at the table and also empowered us to have a voice.
Yes.
And that's really important, and with no ulterior motive and no agenda, except they saw that we deserved it.
Right. I mean, you know, it truly is, when you work hard, you know, it does pay off. You do get noticed. You do get that voice at the table. But, you know, honestly, if I hadn't had really great male bosses along the way, I had a fantastic female mentor in my boss, Pamela Blatz-Murph, who's passed away. But she, and she gave me, you know, every opportunity. But it was only going to go to a certain point, right? I mean, but you had to have the CEOs, you had to have the presidents, you had to have that executive team also have that faith in you. So, you know,
it was Chip Tuttle going through early on at Suffolk Downs, who gave me a real seat at the table.
If you find yourself in a situation where you don't have that male mentor, or you don't have that ability to be heard, and they're not listening to you, find somewhere else. That's a closed door. It's never going to get any better until that management
and they'll
changes.
Only see you in a certain way.
That's right.
So, but back to the Parks point about you know, being elevated to maybe a signal that was bigger than I deserved. The role of the announcer is also changing in horse racing. We've seen Chris Griffin, who I'm replacing at Parks, who had a major social media presence and is a promoter as well.
Yes.
The role of the announcer is not just at this point for many tracks, someone that goes in the booth, calls the races and leaves. So I think with my, you know, strong social media background and ability as a promoter of the sport, that is also part of it. They, you know, you can keep doing things the same way and get the same results, and they wanted something different.
Well, and you're working tirelessly, and everybody needs to, as we say in Yiddish, legangulate and give,
but some,
give,
some
give her
people
a chance.
Never, some people never want a woman's voice. I got an email from someone genuinely saying, I go to the OTB to get away from my old lady's voice. So these are the sort of things you're getting.
This is what you're facing.
I got to say one quick that opened the doors, that lady right down there, Kaitlyn Bradar.
Absolutely.
And she's just, you know, she's got a comforting voice, and she was one of the first ones that actually did the paddock work starting at Gulfstream.
Mm-hmm. Joe Byrne.
And Joe, but what you brings to your point, you maybe you've watched Kaitlyn and said, well, I can do that too. And
yes.
It gave you an opening to see that.
Yeah, so absolutely.
Every time I see Kaitlyn, I was like, because she's the best. I mean,
the best.
Always has been. But I understand you completely when you say, if I don't see somebody doing that I can aspire to be like, then you'd never think that you could do the job.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and if we're going to include those kinds of names, I want to get Jan Rushton's name in.
Oh, sure,
as
absolutely.
Well.
And Lynn Snearson.
You go. Absolutely.
Well, there's many of them.
The list can go on and on, but these women took the arrows in that arena.
Barbara Foster was actually one of the very first ones at Monmouth Park that we had. Like a,
and they didn't have social media nonsense to deal with, but they had a whole different set of nonsense to deal with.
Thank you both. This was spectacular and overdue and timely. Jessica Paquette at Parks, Dora Delgado at Breeders' Cup. Thank you.
Thanks.
We're going to take our break, our second break. When we come back, Michelle Fisher is going to join us, and Michelle visits with us every year. It's important to get Michelle on. And we're also going to talk to Matt Cosgriff, BetMGM. Pat Cummings is going to swing through as well, and at the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined by Lisa Lazarus for the first time from HISA. Back after this, our last hour at Tucson, University of Arizona, Racetrack Industry Program Symposium on Racing. Stay with us.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions, and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all.